the chamber with noise. She can feel her breath in moist plumes, and she runs her cold hands together, the fingertips turned into raisins. She can hear the boys in the dark, their ragged exhalations, their movements as they huddle close under the one sleeping bag. Brett says, Jacob? Yeah. Jacob, do you think she's a ninja? She says, I'm not a ninja. Brett says, she's a ninja, isn't she, Jacob? I'm not a ninja, she says. Brett hems and haws. Sort of. Yes, actually, sort of a ninja. No. Where is your ninja school? Brett asks. I didn't go to ninja school, she says. She's bound by covenants of secrecy, Jacob observes. Or perhaps, Brett says, perhaps the animals of the forest taught her. I'm not a ninja, she yells. The boys sit in chastened silence for a long moment. Then, as if her denial has given final proof to a theory once tenuous, Brett says, she's a ninja. Jacob says, but does she possess preternatural powers? The boys talk in a way that is alarming and exciting to her. Fantastical, gently celebratory, silly. To Turtle, slow of speech, with her inward and circular mind, their facility for language is dizzying. She feels brilliantly included within that province of things she wants, lit up from within by possibility. Giddy and nervous, she watches them, chewing on her fingertips. A new world is opening up for her. She thinks, these boys will be there when I go to high school. She thinks, and what would that be like? To have friends there. To have friends like this. She thinks, every day, get up and get on the bus. And it would be, what, another adventure? And all I would have to do is open my mouth and say, help me with this class. And they would help. Slowly, the boys drop off to sleep, and Turtle lies opposite them. She thinks, I love him. I love him so goddamn much. But let me stay out. Let him come after me. We will see what he does, won't we? Here is a game we play, and I think he knows we play it. I hate him for something. Something he does. He goes too far, and I hate him. But I am unsure in my hatred. Guilty and self-doubting and hating myself almost too much to hold it against him. That is me, a goddamn slut. And so I trespass again to see if he will again do something so bad. It is a way to see if I am right to hate him. I want to know. So you take off and you ask yourself, should I hate him? And I guess you will have your answer when you come back, because he will respond to your absence in a way you can love, or he will respond beyond all reason. And that will be the proof. But always, Turtle, and you know this, he is ahead of you in this game. He will look at you and know exactly how far he can go, and he will take you right to the brink. And then he will see he has come to the brink and he will step back. But perhaps not. Perhaps he will go too far. Or perhaps there is no such calculation in him. An itch is developing on her lower back. She runs her hand along the waistline of her jeans and finds the tick just above the elastic of her panties. She can feel its pearl-smooth body. Brett, she breathes, unbelting her pants and removing the holster, sliding it deeper into the bag to hide it. Jacob? Yeah, Jacob breathes back. Do you have tweezers? Brett does, Jacob says. In his bag. She hears Jacob sit up in the dark. He rustles around in the bag for seemingly a very long time before he finds them. Got them, he says. Tick? Yeah, tick, she says. Where is it? Low down on my back? All right, he says. I can't get it myself, she says. All right. She rolls over onto her belly, hitches her jeans down and her shirt up to bare her lower back. Jacob crawls quietly over to her, trying not to disturb the sleeping Brett. She lies with her cheek resting on the cold black plastic of the ground cloth. Jacob kneels beside her. He turns the headlamp on, and they are bathed in its blue glow. I've never done this before, he says. Get the head, she says. Do you twist it clockwise? He asks. I've heard they screw themselves in. Their mouth parts are an auger. No, it'll vomit out its stomach contents when you start on it. Just pull it straight out in one go if you can, she says. Okay, he says. He puts one hand on the small of her back, framing the tick between thumb and forefinger. His hand is warm and confident, her skin ringing electric. Her vision is narrowly of the black ground cloth, dirty, lapped up in wrinkles, but her focus is entirely on him, unseen, bending over her. Just do it, she says. He is silent. She feels the tweezers fastened down on the tick. They bite into her flesh, and then there is a plucking sensation. You get it all? She says. I got it, he says. You get it all? I got it all, Turtle. Good, she says. She hitches her t-shirt down and rolls back over. She can hear Jacob crushing the tick to death with the tweezer points. The rain drums on the tarp stretched taut above them. Jacob switches off the light, and she listens to them, there in the dark with her. 7. Turtle awakes with a start, heart pounding, and waits, listening, eyes gummy from her dehydration, her mouth leathery. Someone has kicked the center pole away and the tarp hangs down cupped and half full of water. Sunken leaves forming a black circle of detritus at the bottom. She waits, breathing, wondering what woke her. If Martin is standing outside, beside the stump, with his auto shotgun. Slowly, silently, she draws the Sig Sauer and touches it to her cheek. The steel almost warm from the captured heat of the sleeping quilt. She can hear her own labored breath. She thinks, calm down. But she cannot calm down, and she begins to breathe harder. And she thinks, this is bad. This is very bad. Something strikes the water and Turtle jerks. Watches a fist-sized object comet through the water toward her, touch the tarp, and float away. She waits, the gun held against her face in two shaking hands. It is a pine cone, probably a bishop pine cone. This is what woke her. The cones splashing into the pool and striking the tarp. She takes a deep breath, and then startles as a second cone strikes the water and plunges down, slowing as it comes toward her. It touches the tarp, and then floats up and away. Ripples expand across the surface. Their shadows lave across the boys, the sleeping bags, the backpacks, the mess of this little hovel. She thinks, I love everything of theirs because it is theirs. And I like how crowded we are here with things. The riot and disorder. Everything damp and warm. And she thinks, I love it. She pushes her feet down against the wet nylon of Jacob's sleeping bag. She lies, her muscles loosening. And when she can, She holsters the gun and waits with her hands on her throat, looking up at the pool. She wants to draw the gun and cannot bear to lie there without it. And she puts her hand on the grip and touches the uncocked hammer, and she thinks, leave it, leave it. And she takes her hand away and lies listening to the water above and to the forest beyond. She thinks for a moment, I was sure it was him, and the only thing I didn't know was how far he would go and how angry he would be. She thinks, he has always been able to surprise me. When she is calm again, she climbs out, slithering awkwardly through a gap between the tarp and the stump. She sits on the stump's crown, barefoot, jeans sodden and cleaving to her thighs, drinking from the tarp water. She drops off the stump and sits on a log covered in translucent mushrooms shaped like deformed ears. She draws her knife and begins cleaning thorns and slivers from her calloused feet. Around her, wild ginger grows among the redwood roots, its leaves dark green and heart-shaped, its purple flowers, with their open throats and liver-colored tusks, deeply buried in the foliage. She puts her fist against her forehead. If something happens to them, she thinks, what are you doing, Turtle? You are forgetting who you are, and you are thinking that you can be someone else, and you will get yourself hurt, and you will get Martin hurt, and God help you, you will get these boys hurt, and that is the worst of it. But somehow, you cannot care so much for the risk they are taking, being with you. It seems worth the risk, and that shows that you aren't thinking clearly, because it isn't worth the risk. Not for them. Not if you put the question to them. And not if you could explain how far your daddy might go. She thinks, I know that he came after me, and the only question is, if he could find me out here, and I bet he could, but I don't know. She thinks, I can't seem to get that answer straight, because sometimes I think of him, and it seems to me he could do anything. He could, she thinks, hurt these boys. She knows that, and she thinks, don't think of it. She thinks, it is light enough now. I could make it back, and it wouldn't even be hard. Except, what are you giving up on if you do that? She thinks, you know exactly what you're giving up on, and the question is, what are you willing to risk? When it comes down to it, she thinks, I am willing to risk a great deal. I am willing to risk these boys, and it's just for myself, and it's nothing to them. They don't even know, and I won't even tell them. She thinks, if they find out, they find out, and I will take that risk because I am a bitch. Before long, Jacob crawls out and climbs with difficulty down the stump side. He sits beside her and looks at her feet, which are small, with painfully high arches. They look lathed almost, or worked, articulated tendons and bones without any softness. Her callus is contoured like a steam bed and grained like a fingerprint. Jacob watches for a moment. She is glad to see him, and she is particularly glad to see him because of the risks she is taking to make it possible. He doesn't know what he is involved in, and it makes the moment of sitting on the log beside him important to her. He says, well, that's strangely attractive. He nods to where she is digging into the callus with the knife point. His voice is guileless but full of humor, and she smiles despite herself. She does not know if he is making fun of her or if he is making fun of himself. And then, immediately after her smile, she understands. She stiffens, stooped over her feet with knife in hand, tightening her jaw, acutely aware of her bitch face and ugly skin. Her whiteness is ugly and uneven, she knows. A freckled, semi-transparent whiteness so that her boobs, pathetically small and milkily untanned, are almost blue. She feels girded with imperfection and wants to play along with Jacob's teasing, as if her repulsiveness is a prank she's played on herself. She smiles her lopsided half-smile, and smiling, wants to smash to pieces, because she has told herself not to play along when someone is cruel to her. But this boy has so unraveled her that she cannot stick to her intentions. He has a way of watching her that makes her feel as if she is the most important thing in the world. She stoops there, thinking, slit, 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 that unlovely slot lodged between her legs, unfinished by inattention or design, opening into her own peculiarity, its aperture and its sign. And she understands it now. The slit is illiterate. That word undresses her of all that she has knotted and buckled up about herself. She feels collapsed. Every bitter, sluttish part of her collapsed and made identical to that horrible clam. He says, "Where to next, Mowgli?" "You want my help?" Still looking at him, willing to let it go, but unwilling to go without dignity. She's asking for something, and he gives her all of it in his expression alone, which is open and generous and sorry. "Yes, very much." "No poison oak rashes yet," she observes.
"It's gonna be bad," he says.
"Yeah," she says. "I can help." He says, "So it's none of my business?"
"Yes.
But I couldn't help notice, just now, that you have a gun."
"Yeah."
"Why?" he says. She leans and spits into the duff. "Because I can."
"Well, that's true," he says. "But do you think that you might need to shoot someone?"
"It's a precaution," she says.
"Is it, though?" he says.
"Owning a gun, you are 9 times more likely to be shot by a family member than by an intruder." She cracks a knuckle, unimpressed. "I'm sorry," he says, softening. "I'm not challenging you or criticizing, not at all. I just want to hear your perspective, that's all. I don't really think that you're going to be shot by a family member." Before she can answer, Brett groans and stirs and peeks his head out from under the tarp. They break camp. Jacob unknots each line and holds the raveling ends over a lighter, turning the nylon between thumb and forefinger to form a bulb of black. They shake the tarp out, and then she and Brett fold it together until they have a long rectangle. Jacob rolls the bundles on his thighs. Turtle parcels them with half hitches and lashes them to the backpack. Then she stands in the stump and throws down their things to them, and they load all this into the backpacks. They follow the north bank of the river, eating focaccia and hunks of cheese, following broad avenues among the trees where the trickling runoff sorts the rust-colored needles into ripples. Soon, they come to a winding paved road, the asphalt seamed with tar where the cracks have been patched. She thinks, "The hell, I'm just delaying the moment. But the moment will come, and then we will see. And he will be fair with me, or he will be unfair. And if he is fair, then it will be hard." They reach a large engraved redwood burl that reads, "Rivendell Springs Ahead." They have seen no cars and no other people. The world is theirs alone. Brett says, "I think my mom does massage therapy here."
"You mean she's there right now?"
Jacob says.
"Probably. Most days, if she got called in."
"Would she give us a ride?"
"Sure."
They follow the turnoff to a parking lot, with sprays of fairy wands in large blue and gold clay pots, and a high redwood gate. A dozen rundown cars. Brett opens a Ford Explorer with a key from the gas cap, and they stash their bags. A dream catcher hangs from the rearview mirror,
The center console is filled with oils, sunscreens, hand salves, beeswax lip balms. Unopened bills clutter the dash. Jacob pulls off his muddy t-shirt and balls it up and throws it into the passenger footwell before pulling on a clean Humboldt t-shirt. Turtle says, "I'm going to leave you here." She looks back over the forest and she knows it's time. "But you can't go," Brett says. "Why?"
"What if we open that gate?" Jacob says. "And they're all zombies."
"What?"
"If we're forced to wander the post-apocalyptic wastes of Northern California, we want you to be the reticent, shotgun-toting queen of our fellowship."
"I think she'd have a chainsaw for melee," Brett says.
"For zombies," Turtle says, "I'd like a 308. But if we really had to hoof it, you could talk me down to a 556.
"But seriously, what about a chainsaw?" Brett says.
"You'd throw your chain," Turtle says.
"A samurai sword."
"If you're saying zombies," Turtle says, "I'd take a tomahawk, sure. Use all the weight you'd spend on pistol ammo for more 556.
"A shotgun," Jacob says.
"Can't carry enough ammo. For every shot shell you can carry, you could carry 3 or 4 rifle shells. Plus, shotguns reload slowly." Jacob says,
"Couldn't you get an auto shotgun with a magazine, like they have for rifles?"
"Sure," Turtle says, "but rifle shells are metal jacketed and do well in magazines. Shot shells deform under pressure and jam if stored in mags. Plus, auto shotguns are finicky. When you've got to shoot a lot, carry a lot, and scavenge for ammo, 556 is king."
"See? We'll never make it without you. Come on with us," Jacob says.
"Please?
Please?"
She's grinning. "You'd make it."
"Not without you, we wouldn't."
"She's coming," Brett says. "Look at her."
"I'll come." At the gate, they pull the bell cord and the three of them stand together, arguing about how to arm themselves for the coming apocalypse. Turtle barefoot, jeans rolled up to her knees and laden with drying mud. A shirtless man in hemp trousers opens the door, his chest tattooed with a Buddha over crashing waves, his hair in cigar-thick dreadlocks down to his waist.
"Hey, brother," he says to Brett. "Looks like the weather caught you by surprise."
"Hey, Bodhi. Yeah, the weather surprised us some."
"Looking for your mom?"
"Hoping for a ride."
"Who's this?"
"My buddy Jacob, and this is Turtle, the future shotgun-toting, chainsaw-wielding queen of post-apocalyptic America."
"Is she really?" Bodhi says with some interest. "Well, Jacob, Turtle, come on in."
He leads them through a meadow and among large glass pyramids into a redwood forest with moss-hung cabins and redwood barrel-style tubs of steaming water. There is a mineral scent in the air from a hot spring somewhere. They pass a group of naked women, Jacob acutely embarrassed, looking up at the shingle roofs, into the trees, anywhere. They pass another barrel-style tub where three old men bask naked, smoking a blown glass bong. They follow Bodhi to a cottage, the eaves hung with witch's hair, moss growing between the shingles, and they go into a warm interior with a wood stove in one corner. A naked woman sits cross-legged on a wooden pedestal, eating cherry tomatoes from a lacquered wooden bowl. Jacob's eyes goggle in surprise. The woman is olive-skinned, with wiry black hair bundled in hemp cords. Her face pretty and open, her nipples big, the areolas soft brown and goose-bumpy, her belly somewhere between soft and firm, the skin healthy-looking but worn. Her pussy has 2 little interior pieces of flesh hanging out. Turtle's own pussy is as trim and compact as an anemone bunkered down to wait out the tide. Brett says, "Guys, this is my mom, Caroline. Mom, could you...
And the woman says, Julia Alveston?
Both Brett and Jacob turn toward Turtle in surprise.
Turtle says, What?
Brett says, Mom, could you put on some pants?
Caroline says, Oh, girly, I haven't seen you since you were this high.
She holds out a hand 3 feet above the ground.
Your mom, Helena, was my best friend. And boy, I tell you, she was a... Well...
Turtle feels an immediate revulsion. She thinks, Don't you talk about my mother, you cunt, you stranger.
Brett's mom now turns to look at the boys.
Tell me what's happened, she says.
Brett says, Mom, could you...
Of course, she says, rising and pulling on hemp drawstring pants while the boys take turns explaining.
Jacob says, She just sort of showed up.
She was just out in the dark. No flashlight, no backpack, no shoes, nothing. Getting along just fine. Like she could see in the dark. In the pouring rain, pitch black.
You should see her feet. Calluses? It's insane.
She just walks everywhere barefoot.
She doesn't feel cold.
Or pain.
Only justice.
We think she might be a ninja.
She denies this.
But of course, she'd have to deny it.
If she said yes, she was a ninja, we'd know she wasn't.
I wouldn't describe the ninja theory as definitive, but it's a live possibility.
Anyway, she led us out of the Valley of the Shadow.
She can see in the dark.
She can walk across water.
She has her own pace. She just stops, and she looks, and she stands there looking, and you're all like, What are you looking at? But she just keeps looking, and you're like, aren't you bored yet? But that's because she's a Zen master.
She's very patient.
Her conversational pace isn't what you'd call usual.
I'm right here, Turtle says.
She's thoughtful, but there's something more and stranger than that.
It's less thoughtful than watchful.
Yeah, watchful. You ask her a question, and she just, like, watches you, and you're like, And if you wait long enough, she comes out with an answer.
She can tie knots. She can find her way in the forest.
The animals speak to her and tell her their secrets.
When they are done, Caroline says, Well, boys, that's very evocative. Then she turns to Turtle. How is your father these days?
He's good, Turtle says.
Is he working hard?
Not too hard, Turtle says.
Is he dating? Caroline asks.
I bet he is.
No, Turtle says.
No, Caroline says. He was always the kind of guy, had to have a woman in his life.
She smiles.
A real charmer, your father.
No, there are no women in his life. Turtle says, a little menacingly.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. Must get lonely up on that hill.
I don't know, Turtle says. There's Grandpa, and there's the orchard and the creek. And then he has his poker buddies.
Well, Caroline says, people change. But your father was one of the handsomest men I ever knew.
Still is, I bet.
Mom! Brett says in exasperation. That's gross.
He was quite a looker, Caroline says, and an intelligent man. I always thought he would do something.
He hasn't done anything, Turtle says.
He's raised you, and what a strong-looking girl you've come up to be, Caroline says. Though, I have to say, you look about half wild.
Turtle says nothing to that.
Caroline says, So, Julia, they met up with you a couple miles from here?
Turtle nods.
It sounds like it was pretty much in the middle of nowhere.
I was on a walk, Turtle says.
Starting where?
What?
Turtle cups her hand around her ear and leans forward.
Where do you start out?
At my house.
You walked here from Buckhorn?
Caroline says.
Yes, that's right, Turtle says.
Came up out of Slaughterhouse Gulch, through the airport, and then above the banks of the Albion, sort of past people's backyards.
Well, sweetheart, you look roughed up enough for it, that's for sure.
That must be miles and miles. With no water? No food?
Turtle chews, opening her jaw and closing it. She looks at the floor.
Caroline says, Sweetheart, I'm just worried about you. What were you doing out there in the middle of the night? How far is that from your home, do you think?
I don't know, Turtle says.
Right, Caroline says. Why don't you take Jacob out and show him the glass pyramids?
The boys exchange looks, and Brett jerks his head in a come-on gesture, and they both leave.
Turtle stands in the middle of the floor, wringing her hands together and looking at the base of Caroline's pedestal.
Did you know, Caroline says, I was almost your godmother?
Turtle cracks a knuckle, looks up at Caroline, and can almost remember her from a dim past. She senses a need to go carefully here and to protect her own small life on Buckhorn Hill.
Your mother and I used to tear up the town together, and I tell you, we did our fair share of tramping around in these woods when we were a little older than you, and it was all kissing boys and dropping acid. After school, we used to go down to the headlands, and there was this cypress on the bluffs between Big River and Portuguese Beach. We'd hang our feet over the bluffs and look down at the little hidden coves and out at the islands, and we'd talk and talk and talk.
Turtle is silent. She thinks, this bitch. This bitch.
You have any good girlfriends in school?
No.
Nobody?
No.
How are you liking it?
Fine.
But there are women in your life, I hope.
Turtle says nothing.
And Martin? I bet he's a wonder helping you.
Yeah, he is.
He could explain anything if he wanted.
Yeah. He has a way with words, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He was the most imaginative person I ever met. Goddess, he could read and talk, can't he?
Yes, Turtle smiles.
He's a good guy, Caroline says. But when he's angry, he sure can hit hard, can't he?
Turtle runs her tongue along her teeth. She says, What? She thinks, You bitch, you whore. It is the kind of trick people play with kids. They try and get you to answer a lot of questions, and then they ask you a question about your family. Turtle's seen it before. Women are always cunts in the end, no matter how they start up. Always some axe to grind. Caroline sits cross-legged on her stool and watches Turtle with serene attentiveness. And Turtle thinks, You bitch. You fucking whore. I knew it would come, and it came.
Well, Caroline says, seeing her error, backpedaling. He used to have a temper on him.
Turtle stands there.
I remember when we were just kids. Just, well, goddess, he had a temper. That's all I'm saying. Just that sometimes he had a temper on him. So, how is he these days? Caroline asks.
I've got to go. Turtle turns.
Wait, Caroline says.
Turtle strips all emotion out of her face, but not quite out of her posture, and she thinks, Look at me. She thinks, Look at me. You know that I take this seriously. Look at me. If you ever try and take him away, you will see.
Did I say something wrong?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Julia, sweetheart, I'm just wondering how things are at home. I can't tell you how often I've thought of you over these years. How many times I thought I saw you at corners of the mouth, or waiting in front of the post office, or walking through Hayter Field, and could never be sure because, of course, I didn't know you. And now that you're here, well, of course it's you. You look just like your mom. Turtle says, my daddy would never. I know, sweetheart, I'm just curious, Caroline says. You know, I was so close to your mother, I'm allowed to worry a little bit. You and I, we'd know each other if she was still alive, and you and Brett would have grown up like brother and sister. But instead, I don't know you at all. I can't help thinking that it's a weird turn of fate, you know? That she left us and you grew up not even knowing me. And good goddess, girl, you need some women in your life. Turtle stares at Caroline, thinking, I have never known a woman I liked, and I will grow up to be nothing like you or like Anna. I will grow up to be forthright and hard and dangerous, not a subtle, smiling, trick-playing cunt like you. Oh, Caroline says, sweetheart, let me drive you home. I'd like to talk to Marty. It's been ages. I don't know, Turtle says. Oh, honey, I can't let you walk all those miles back home. I just can't. If you'd rather, I'll call your father and he can come pick you up. But it's an hour out of his way, and I'd much rather just take you home myself. Turtle thinks, I will be in the car with this woman, and her thinking things about Martin. But she wants to see how Caroline talks to him. She wants to be there. She half wants to know what Caroline thinks, and half she doesn't. 8. It is near sundown when they reach the turnoff for Turtle's house. Caroline drives hard up the washboard gravel, just about 600 yards, the Explorer lurching in and out of ruts. She keeps saying, look at this, Julia, goddess, if you knew how this place used to look. The boys have their hands and faces pressed to the glass and look out at the fields with fascination. The driveway runs up the northern edge of the hill, and on their left, it's all shore pines standing above Slaughterhouse Gulch, which cuts west below them. Above them, they can just see the house at the crest of the hill, all of the windows dark. On their right, the fields run until they meet the orchard, beyond which, and hidden from them, are the raspberry fields and Grandpa's trailer. A stream cuts its way through the grass, visible only as a seam of thimbleberry and hazelnut. Turtle thinks, we will see how this goes, but he will not be hard on me until they are gone. Caroline slows down, looking at the pampas grass beside the road, and says, Daniel used to be more proud of that meadow than anything, I think. I don't know how many hours he spent tending this meadow. And you know, it used to be just all Timothy, as far as you could see, just Timothy. But he's let it get away from him, hasn't he? Deer lying on the warm gravel lurch to their feet and bolt into the grass. She looks at Turtle and says, it's a jungle you're growing up in, isn't it? Look, Brett says, look! They can see a flat shoulder of the hillside, not far from the orchard, thickly overgrown in wild oats, where 7 doors stand in a circle, without any walls or framing. Ravens stand on the lintels, cocking their heads to watch the Explorer come up the drive. Caroline looks over at Turtle, and then up to the house, where the white roses have climbed up among the windows and up onto the second story, braided with poison oak, which throws long, crinkly green and red shoots high into the air. Look at that, Caroline says. Look at that. Look at all those roses. When I was last here, what, over 10 years ago? This was all different, Julia.
All of those roses were pruned and tied up on lattices, and the house was newly painted. That field had not a weed in it, and that driveway was beautiful new gravel. I can't believe how it's all changed. Those roses, no one even knows the cultivar. There was some kind of rose specialist out here to examine them once and take cuttings. Your great-great-grandma was a rose enthusiast and had all kinds of rose varieties, including some that were found only here in Mendocino that are now thought to be gone, except maybe here they are. And there were pots on the porch, big glazed pots, just full of lettuce and kale and onions and garlic, squash and artichokes. And there were, she points out by the deck off the master bedroom, there were beehives. Oh, Turtle says. Grandpa still has the hives. They're out in the orchard. And the orchard? It wasn't overgrown at all like that. Do those trees still fruit? Not really, Turtle says. She looks at the orchard. The trees gone to shoots, spring after spring without pruning. Wickerwork hulks in a sea of blackberries. That orchard was in a lawn. I mean a lawn that your grandfather used to mow. And look at it now. Just look at that. Those trees look awful. I mean, they look miserable. Oh, honey. Turtle puts her fingers in her mouth. She doesn't like how Caroline is talking, like it's her daddy's fault that the trees stopped bearing fruit. Her daddy's fault that the field is going to weeds. And what she's not saying is how Grandpa used up all the money, and her mother died, and how Martin is raising Turtle on his own, picking up jobs where he can, and isn't in the same position that maybe Grandpa was when Grandma was alive and he was retired and had money. Martin is sitting in an Adirondack chair holding a Red Seal ale in one hand, watching them. He's got his Colt 1911 45 sitting on the arm of the chair, and laid up against the back of the chair, a Sega shotgun. Evening light slants across the hill from the lambent blue ocean. Stay in the car, boys, Caroline says to Jacob and Brett, who peer through the tinted windows at the big man on the porch. He raises himself slowly, puts the Colt in the waist of his jeans, and walks carefully down the steps. Caroline winds down her window, and Martin comes abreast of the SUV, and then leans through the window, more than spanning it with his shoulders, propping his elbows on the door so the car sinks to the side. Turtle's vision flexes with anxiety, and her hair prickles up across her arms and legs, on her scalp, on the back of her neck, and a feeling of cold follows after, running down her body. He looks into the interior, right at Caroline, and she doesn't talk for a moment, and he seems to chew on what he's seeing before he breaks into a crooked grin. Well, Caroline, he says, God, but it's terrific to see you. Martin, I've found your daughter. If only you'd found her mother, he says. At this, Caroline opens and closes her mouth at a loss. But Martin goes on, almost kindly, almost as if to put her at ease, nodding to indicate Julia and saying, that girl, sharing a roguish look with Caroline, a look so conspiring and full of good humor that she smiles despite herself. Marty, she says, trying to sound stern. She was way out in Little River, almost in Compte. Well, Martin says, that's just a hop, a skip, and a jump for her. Between you and me, there's no holding that girl back, Caroline. I've known her to go 30 miles across country in a single day. The girl's part Helena McFarlane, part Wildcat. You can't wear her out. Between you and me, Caroline, it is a thing out of myth, almost. You could hamstring her and drive her away out into the bush and leave her there,
and you would come back to find she had taken up with wolves and founded a kingdom. When she was just a little thing, she'd walk all the way to the Little River Market. I am talking about a child in diapers, barefoot, and the girls at the register would give her a stick of butter to eat and give me a call. Once, a little older, she walked all the way to the 10-mile river before I found her. But if you're too hard on her about it, you just drive her away. Isn't that right, kiddo? Turtle, named this way, smiles and then looks quickly away. Martin is taking pleasure in talking. He goes on. God, Caroline, raking his fingers through his hair. You look just like you did a decade ago. You know that? Oh, stop, Caroline says, smiling despite herself. Just the exact same way, Martin says. Little more gray in my hair, Caroline says. But it suits you, Martin says, turning his attention to her mop of wiry salt and pepper hair. It's the only thing that keeps you from looking like a 20-something. It's this sea air and that olive complexion of yours. How are things? Are you sure there isn't a picture of you somewhere? Martin inquires, getting more aged and wicked with every passing day. No such thing, Caroline says. Just good living, then. As for me, Martin says, looking away from the car and out at the setting sun above the ocean. Things have never been better. Well, Caroline says. Well, Martin says, catching some meaning she conveys. I have my daughter, and God, but that's more than enough for anybody. As you can see, she keeps my hands full. If you can't find happiness there, in a girl like that, Christ, I don't think it'd be worth living. She's everything to me, Caroline. Look at her. And a great beauty, too, isn't she? Yes, she is, Caroline says, sounding a little doubtful on the subject of Turtle's beauty. You know, you can't be too hard on the girl. She's just like you were, except so far, no boys and no psilocybin. I told her the same thing, she says, laughing. That's exactly what I said. Because it's true. Look at her. I hope you weren't too hard on her, Martin says. And both adults look appraisingly at Turtle. I could use your advice, though, Martin says. You'll have it, Caroline says. Martin looks out at the ocean and, narrowing his eyes as if describing something in the far-off distance, he says, kibble, and then pauses for a long moment to compose his description. She struggles in school, not with everything, but with English, with her vocabulary lists. There is silence from the back seat. A creak of springs as Jacob leans forward to catch this. Turtle chews her fingers, angry that he would bring this up in front of her friends. Oh, well, Caroline says with a sympathetic glance at Turtle. Don't we all struggle with that? Martin nods in acknowledgement, slowly and humorlessly. There's nothing I've found, but just to help them through it, though Goddess knows that's not easy. Martin, this is my boy Brett. Brett leans forward, and they shake hands. Martin reaching in through the window and smiling at Brett with his jaw standing out and his flannel hanging open. Well now, Martin says. What a big, handsome boy. He looks back at Caroline. She seems to be searching his face for something that isn't there. She has turned away from Turtle, and Turtle cannot tell what she is thinking. But Turtle knows that Caroline must be putting on an act, that she must be worried and trying to suss something out. Turtle looks at Martin and wonders if he knows that. And looking at him, she thinks he does. Caroline says, You should have me over more often, Martin. I'd like to be a part of the girl's life. Of course, Martin says. It's the same phone number,
Caroline says.
Truly? Martin says. The same number. Well, I have it then.
The same house, even.
Out on Flynn Creek Road? I remember that house very well. Still infested with brown recluses?
You have to knock every stick of kindling against a post before you can bring it inside.
Well, Martin says in wonder. Anyway, I have your number, and I will give you a call.
I'd like that, Caroline says.
Come on, Kibble,
Martin says. And Turtle opens the door and hooks something in the footwell with her toe and pitches it out into the grass unnoticed, and then climbs out. She looks once at the boys and closes the door and steps back from the car. Caroline waves a final goodbye to Martin, pulls the SUV around, and goes down the driveway, leaving Turtle and Martin standing side by side, watching them go. Martin, silent, walks back to the Adirondack chair and sits down in it. He picks his cigar up from the arm and tosses open the Zippo's lid and lights it, puffing and squinting into the smoke. He draws on the cigar and then fits it between two fingers, and she climbs up the porch steps and sits down on his knee, and he pulls her back into the depths of the chair and puts one big, tobacco-smelling arm around her, cupping her hair to her neck, and they are silent for a long time. He puts his face into the nape of her neck and inhales. With the hand slung over her shoulder, he gestures down to the hill, to the fields.
When you were just a little thing, he says, you couldn't have weighed more than 50 pounds. Your mother, she'd let you out to play. You were way out in the field, at the edge of the orchard, and the grass was high that year, as high as you were. And I come out onto the porch to have a smoke, and I'm looking, and I can just barely make you out, down there, with this little toy monster you had, a toy Godzilla. You were making it walk through the grass, and I could just barely see you. And not 30 feet from you, half hidden in the grass, was the biggest mountain lion I've ever seen, sitting there, watching you. The biggest son of a bitch I've ever seen, Kibble.
He has his arm around her, and his embrace is exceptionally gentle. But Turtle can feel the strength of it. He draws air sharply through his teeth, shaking his head, like he does when something hurts him. He says,
so I went into the house, and I got the gun, and I walked out onto the porch, and I couldn't see the damn cat.
She sits smelling him, enclosed within his embrace, looking over the fields and thinking about that. Where the field is still healthy, the timothy is all of a height, green and riffled by the wind. The wild oats stand with panicles arched, spikelets stirring. Soon, she knows, the meadow will be overgrown with weeds. She looks down at the decking and notices his boot prints, which are orange and gray clay. She sits looking at that, and then turns her attention to the ash-colored clay on the treads of his boots. There isn't any clay like that on their property, not that she knows. He turns her in his lap so he can look at her. He says,
God damn it, Kibble. I came to the porch, and I looked out with the gun, and I couldn't see the cat. It was summer, and all the grass was that yellow color it gets, and the cat was almost that same color. I knew it was out there, but I couldn't see it in the high grass. I just stood there, Kibble, and I knew that that fucking cat was out there. And maybe if I called you, that'd set him off, make him chase you. I could see you. You were just crawling around in the grass, and I stood there, and I just didn't know what to do.
She hangs her arms around his neck and presses her ear against the flannel breast of his shirt. She can feel the stubble of his chin, smell the smoke of the Swisher sweets, the malty smell of the beer. There is clay on the edge of the stair where he wiped the mud free of the treads of his boots. Clay and the small, brittle leaves of huckleberries. Martin says,
I'm not sure that you understand what I'm trying to tell you, Kibble, because I thought I might lose you, and I didn't know what to do. I thought, you know what I thought, Kibble? I thought that I could never lose you, never let you go. You are mine. But I might not always be there. I might not always be fast enough or smart enough, Kibble. And the world is a bad place. It's a really fucking bad place.
What happened?
You stood up, he says. You just stood up, and you looked out into the grass, holding that goddamn toy in one hand. And I knew that you were looking at the cat. Christ, you must have been looking right at him. I was standing at the edge of the porch. I just couldn't find him in the grass. It was like he was invisible.
He sucks air through his teeth. Veins stand out on his burnished forearms and snake over the backs of his hands. His knuckles are leathern burls. His fingers are cross-hatched with scars. She looks down at the knees of his Levi's, stained with grease and rust. And she reaches down and picks at a scab-like crust of epoxy. There are mud and leaves on the ankles of his Levi's. Lapped in a fold of denim, the tiny, tight-lipped pink urn and lipstick pedestal of a pygmy manzanita flower. He says,
Those bastards. They can get so close to the ground and just wait. This motherfucker. I knelt at the edge of the porch, and I found you in the scope, and I put the reticule right on you. At first, I thought that I could catch him right before he was on you. And then I thought, I'd kill you myself rather than let that cat have you. Rather than let you get dragged into the grass and disemboweled. That is what they do. Grasp you with their mouth and their forepaws, and then kick out with their hind paws to disembowel you. And the hell if I was going to let that happen. Put that reticule right on your temple, and it would be over, poofed, and a red mist, rather than let that cat open you up.
Did you see the cat, Daddy?
No. You just turned around and walked right up the hill and onto the porch, and I knew that the son of a bitch was out there, ready to take you away from me. You came and held on to my pant leg, and I just stood there until you went inside. It got dark, and you came out and said you were hungry.
Would you really have shot me?
You're my little girl, Kibble. You're everything to your old man. And I will never, ever let you go. But I don't know. I guess it's hard to say what's right.
You and me, Turtle says, against the world.
That's right, he says.
I'm sorry I went off, Daddy.
Where'd you go?
East, she says. East above the Albion. There are redwoods out there, Daddy. He nods and looks east.
There are growers out there, and I don't think any of them would ever hurt a child, I don't think. But they've got dogs that would. And Kibble, they're people. And in the way of people, they're not all of them good. You be careful. I think it's better if you don't ever go away like that again. But we'll let it go this once.
Daddy, she says, on a ridge way over above the Albion, there was a tarantula. He holds her for a while. Then he says,
No, Kibble, there aren't any tarantulas over there.
No, Daddy, I saw one. It was as big as my hand.
You didn't see no spider like that, Kibble.
But, Daddy...
Kibble, he says.
Yes, Daddy.